They told you Buttercup was the tough one, the fearless one. But what happens when the strongest Powerpuff Girl vanishes and wakes up in the grip of her worst enemy? This isn't a story about fists. It's about control, about identity, about a girl whose mind was hijacked by Mojo Jojo and the brutal silent war she fought to get it back. She didn't just escape his lab. She shattered his empire from the inside out. This is the story of survival, rebellion, and the fire it takes to remember your own name. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Mind Games. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. The cage you can't see. You don't notice the chains until you try to move. That's how it always starts. Not with screaming alarms or visible bars, but with softness, with comfort, with someone offering exactly what you think you need in the moment you're at your lowest. They don't grab your wrist, they take your hand. They don't shout, they whisper. And by the time you realize you're not free, it's too late. The door has long since closed behind you, silent as snowfall. I remember the exact moment my world fractured. I had just come back from a mission, if you could even call it that. The town was supposed to be safe. Routine. Blossom had a plan. Bubbles had hope. And I had a temper. That temper got someone hurt. Badly. I remember their face. White eyes. A gasp of pain that cut through the chaos like glass shattering inside me. I tried to apologize. I really did. But they looked at me like I was a monster. Not a hero. Not a sister. Just dangerous. I don't remember how long I flew after that. Hours, maybe. I didn't eat. I didn't sleep. I just kept going, hoping the wind in my ears would drown out the thoughts. That maybe I'd find a place where no one knew me. Where I didn't have to explain why the strongest one always seemed the most broken. And then, like fate had been watching me unravel, he appeared. Mojo Jojo. I should have known better. I did know better. But he wasn't how I remembered him. Not cackling, not explosive. He was quiet, measured, almost gentle. He spoke slowly, deliberately. Each word coded in this unnerving calmness that made my thoughts slow down just to keep pace. You look lost, he said. I didn't respond. I didn't have the strength. I understand what it means to be cast out. To be seen as a threat simply for existing. My heart caught in my throat. He sounded almost human. He didn't attack. He didn't gloat. He offered shelter, somewhere off-grid, somewhere quiet. He said he had studied the human mind. That he could help me understand mine. That all this pain, all this rage, wasn't a curse. But a signal. A clue that I wasn't being used the way I should be. I told myself I was only staying for a night. That was 3 months ago. The compound was underground, tucked into the mountains like a secret. No windows. Just corridors that looped like a maze. Walls too smooth to touch without wondering if they were listening. The air was always the same temperature. The lights never flickered. There were no clocks, and I stopped keeping track of time the day he took my watch. A distraction, he called it. First, it felt like therapy. Mojo spoke in metaphors, in riddles, in spirals of thought that both confused and enlightened me. He would dissect my memories like a surgeon, helping me relive old wounds only to plant new interpretations in their place. He never yelled. He never had to. His power wasn't in force, it was in precision. Every compliment was followed by a subtle correction. Every correction came with praise when I accepted it. Over time, the lines between my thoughts and his suggestions blurred. I didn't realize it until I found myself quoting him. In my own voice. Pain is potential. Anger is a compass. Loyalty is a leash. He called me Subject Zero. Said I was the first successful test of what he called cognitive purification. I thought it was a joke at first. Until I saw the others. He's vacant. Miles fixed. Parroting him like gospel. They didn't speak to me directly. They didn't need to. Their silence was a warning. Their obedience a prophecy. And yet part of me stayed, because some part of me still believed he was helping, that he understood me in ways no one else ever had, that he was unlocking something within me, something my sisters had always tried to suppress, something real. I'd given up contact with the outside world by then. He told me Townsville had declared me a threat, that I was labeled rogue, that my sisters had issued a statement saying they no longer claimed me as one of their own. He even showed me footage. Blossom, cold and calculated. Bubbles, tearful but resolute. We tried everything we could. "She's gone," they said. I believed it. Course I believed it. Who wouldn't? The moment I cried, Mojo held me. Not with arms, but with words. "This is your rebirth," he whispered. "Now you can finally become who you were meant to be." And I wanted that. God, I needed that. I didn't realize the tea he gave me every night was more than just herbal. I didn't notice the thin white pill at the bottom until I coughed mid-sip and it clinked against my teeth. When I looked up, his face didn't change. Not even a twitch. Just that same calm smile. "You've been progressing so well," he said softly. "No need to worry about side effects. The clarity is worth it." Side effects. As if clarity was something you could chemically induce. That night I didn't sleep. Not because I was afraid, but because for the first time in weeks, maybe longer, I felt a spark. A thought that wasn't pre-approved. A doubt that hadn't been filtered. The next morning I flushed the tea. And suddenly, the fog began to lift. It wasn't instant. Came in flickers. Memories unaltered. Feelings unfiltered. I remembered Bubbles singing off-key in the kitchen. Blossom pacing when she was nervous. The scent of home. The laughter that didn't have strings attached. And I remembered who I was before all this. The guilt came first, like a wave crashing over me, choking and cold. Then came the fear. Because I knew, without a shadow of a doubt, that Mojo Jojo was not just trying to control me. He already was. He had been for weeks. Maybe longer. But I didn't let it show. I thanked him for the tea with a smile. I repeated my affirmations with a nod. I walked his maze and listened to his voice and let him believe I was still under his thumb. 'Cause now I understood what game we were playing. And I was done being a pawn. I would play the role for as long as I needed to. Until I knew the terrain. The schedule. Exits. The surveillance blind spots. Every variable in this equation he thought he had mastered. Because to escape Mojo Jojo, you can't just run. You have to outthink him. You have to beat him at his own game. And I'm ready to begin. Chapter 2. The game beneath the silence. The day I stopped drinking the tea, the air changed. Not literally, of course. The climate control system in the compound ensured nothing ever changed. No breeze, no humidity, no scent of rain or grass or asphalt baking under the sun. Just sterile, recycled air, always at the same temperature, always the same quiet hum in the background. But something felt different. Something shifted. It was in the way the lights buzzed overhead a fraction longer before flickering on. In the way the guards, those mindless, uniformed extensions of Mojo's will, turned their heads half a second too slow when I passed. In the silence between his words. The space between syllables. He knew. Or at least he suspected. And suspicion, for someone like Mojo Jojo, was as good as certainty. That morning, he greeted me the same way he always did. Clasped his gloved hands together in mock reverence. Head cocked to the side like a curious bird. His voice oozed with faux affection, rich and syrupy. Every syllable stretched and deliberate. "Good morning, Subject Zero," he said as I entered the chamber. "Did you sleep well?" He nodded. "Better than usual." He smiled wider. "That's excellent. Sleep is the gateway to mental clarity. And clarity." He paused, letting the word hang like perfume in the air. "Is our ultimate goal, is it not?" I echoed his rehearsed phrases. "Clarity leads to obedience. Obedience leads to peace." "Very good," he purred, pleased. "But I didn't mean it. Not anymore." The lie tasted like blood in my mouth, but I swallowed it down. 'Cause this was war now. A silent, invisible war waged not with fists or fireballs, but with measured words, controlled expressions, and internal resistance. A war where each smile I faked was a dagger. Each step I took according to his rules was a move on a chessboard he thought he controlled. I spent that entire day observing. Not reacting, observing. First the cameras. There were dozens, hidden in plain sight. Embedded in the corners of the halls, nestled in the bulbs of the overhead lights, blinking in rhythmic sync with the vents that hissed like serpents. But not all of them moved. And not all of them were real. I tested this by standing still in one of the main hallways for exactly 13 minutes. Not pacing. Not fidgeting. Just staring. The hallway curved in two directions. One camera directly above me was fixed. Dead center. No blinking. No hum. Nothing. I stood so long I felt the synthetic air dry my eyes. But no one came. Not a guard. Not Mojo. Not even a voice from the intercom. It was a blind spot. A tiny, insignificant crack in his perfect system. But it was a start. That night I didn't sleep. Again. Instead, I lay on the rigid cot he called a cleansing platform, and stared at the low ceiling while my mind spiraled. Eyes wide, heart pounding. I couldn't afford dreams anymore. Dreams were too dangerous, too vivid. He watched those two. The supplements he laced into my food, at least until recently, had made my REM sleep his playground. Without the drugs, my dreams returned. And so did the danger. Because the more vivid they became, the harder they were to hide. The second morning after I stopped the tea, I slipped up. He noticed. Subject zero, he said, brows arching in mild curiosity as we met for our daily session. You appear distracted. I just didn't sleep well, I replied, brushing hair from my face. Bad dream. Ah, dreams. He smiled thinly. Unstructured, unfiltered thought. Often a sign of resistance. Or regression. There it was. He knew. Not completely, but enough to be dangerous. He leaned closer, the silver rings on his fingers clicking against the desk. Would you care to share it? Forced a laugh. I don't remember. He didn't blink. Didn't press. Just nodded once and made a small note in his leather-bound journal. I didn't know whether he was actually writing or just pretending to rattle me. I left the session with my skin crawling. He was testing me now. Measuring responses, gauging emotional spikes. He was pushing gently, like a scientist prodding a lab rat, just to see which corner of the maze I'd retreat to. I didn't flinch. Couldn't. Instead, I gave him what he wanted. More sessions. More progress. More affirmations spoken through gritted teeth. But behind the mask, I was cataloging everything. Every hallway. Every lock code I caught a glimpse of. Every guard rotation. Every blink of a camera that wasn't synchronized. I started timing his visits down to the second, memorizing the intervals in which he left the control room unattended. I started faking the shakes. Small tremors in my hands. A twitch at the corner of my eye. Subtle signs of withdrawal. He took the bait. Perhaps, he murmured, we should increase your dosage again. I nodded solemnly. If you think it's best. That night, I slipped the pill under my tongue, then flushed it down the vent when the cameras turned away. I was getting better at this. Harper. More careful. But the truth was, I was scared. Because no matter how smart I thought I was being, he was always one step ahead, or at least he wanted me to believe that. That was his real gift. Not strength. Not strategy. But psychological pressure so suffocating it made you question if the rebellion was even real, or just something he wanted you to attempt. So he could crush you. More than once, I found myself doubting the plan. Doubting myself. Was this just another loop? Another layer of control. But then I'd remember my sisters. Their laughter. Their warmth. I'd remember how Blossom used to overthink everything and how Bubbles would still cry at cartoons even after saving the world. I'd remember flying side by side with them, fists clenched, wind roaring in our ears like thunder. I'd remember what love felt like, pure and complicated and loud. And that would remind me exactly why I had to keep going. I wasn't just escaping for me. I was escaping for the girl I used to be. For the family I had lost. For the future Mojo thought he could erase. The next day I stole a map. It wasn't easy. I had to trick one of the control room aides, one of the brainwashed ones, into rebooting the security monitors while I accidentally spilled water over the master screen. In the 20 seconds it took for the system to reset, I snapped a photo with a small reflective panel I'd fashioned out of a broken food tray. Later, under the flickering light of my quarters, I studied the reflection like it was scripture. The compound was larger than I realized. Multiple levels, sub-basements, reinforced exits. There were two emergency tunnels that led to surface access. One was clearly sealed. The other might still be operational. It was locked behind biometric sensors and encrypted code, both things I didn't yet have access to. But now I had a target. For the first time in months, I had hope. And Mojo. He still thought I was his obedient little soldier. Still thought I was circling his drain. Let him think it. 'Cause I was done playing defense. The mind games were far from over. For now, I was ready to make my move. Chapter 3, Breaking the Mirror. There's a certain kind of silence that feels alive. It breathes against your skin, slithers into your ears, settles behind your ribs and expands until your chest feels too tight, like you've swallowed static. That's the kind of silence that filled the compound now. Buzzing, weighted, charged with invisible tension. Mojo was watching me more closely. I could feel it in the shift of the lights, in the way the guards now lingered at intersections they used to walk right past, their blank eyes sweeping a fraction slower over my body like they were waiting for a crack. Deviation. A confession that would never come. The mind games were evolving. But so was I. And if Mojo wanted to play predator and prey, I would be the mirror in his maze, reflecting everything back at him until he couldn't tell which one of us was truly in control. But I needed help. I knew from the start I couldn't do this alone. Not just because of the size of the facility or the layers of surveillance, but because Mojo's grip wasn't just physical. It was emotional. Psychological. It ran through the minds of every person inside these walls like a current. If I wanted to short-circuit the system, I had to insert myself into it. And to do that, I had to break one of his toys. Her name was Isla. Or at least, that's what Mojo called her. She was one of his cleansed. Model subject. Pale blue uniform, shaved head. No visible emotion except when she was looking at Mojo. Then she lit up like he'd hung the moon. The kind of devotion that wasn't born. It was built. Brick by brick. Whisper by whisper. A woman so broken she had mistaken her jailer for a god. I watched her for 3 days. She cleaned the labs, sorted the chemicals, tracked inventory. Every movement was precise, robotic. Yet occasionally, just occasionally, her hands trembled. Not fear. Not sickness. Something else. Remembrance. Ella was cracked porcelain. Not shattered. Not beyond repair. And cracks could be widened. The first interaction was subtle. I dropped my tray in the dining hall. Spilled everything across the polished floor. Isla was there instantly. Kneeling beside me like a spring-loaded doll. Let me, she said, voice flat. No, it's okay, I said, brushing her hand by accident. She recoiled, not violently, but enough for me to see it. A flash of hesitation in her eyes. A twitch at the corner of her mouth. She wasn't used to touch. And I made a note of that. I made a lot of notes. By the fourth day, I sat across from her during mealtime. Carefully, like I'd wandered into the seat by accident. She didn't speak, didn't look up. Just spooned her colorless soup into her mouth like it was fuel. But I could feel her attention flicking toward me like a heartbeat. On the sixth day I said something simple. You used to be someone else. She froze mid-spoon. Just for a second. Then she resumed. I don't remember, she said flatly. You do, I said. Quiet. Not a challenge, just a fact. That night, I slipped a tiny paper beneath her cot. A drawing. Just a sketch. A single daisy, inked with charcoal. It wasn't much. But I needed to see if she'd react. The next morning it was gone. She didn't acknowledge it. But during breakfast, her tray was missing a spoon. It was small, barely noticeable. But to me, it was the beginning of a language. Signal. She was still in there. And now she knew I was too. I started leaving more. A folded origami star. A line from a poem I only half remembered. Little pieces of beauty, of rebellion, of memory. No directives. No instructions. Just fragments. I didn't ask her to help me. I needed her to want to. And one night, nearly 2 weeks after the first sketch, I returned to my quarters and found something on my cot. Matchstick. Singed at the end. That was it. But it was enough. Fire. She remembered fire. The next day I changed tactics. I waited until the guards rotated. One of them was sloppier than the others, a twitchy man with a scar over his left eye who liked to sneak smokes behind the air filtration units. I timed his break, slipped past the blind spot in the east corridor, and met Isla outside the hydroponics lab. "I need access to sub-level 3, I whispered, keeping my eyes on the floor. "I know you go there. You have clearance." She didn't respond. Not at first. But her hand reached into her sleeve and passed me something smooth and cold. Keycard. Unlabeled. Silent. Then she walked away like nothing had happened. I barely slept that night. My thoughts raced in overlapping circles, looping through every possibility. Was it real? Was it a trap? Had Mojo orchestrated it to see how far I'd go? But then I remembered the matchstick. And I remembered something more important than fear. Trust isn't given in places like this. It's traded. I tested the card 2 days later. Just a scan, quick and subtle. It worked. One green light. One soft beep that sang like a symphony. Sub-level 3 wasn't like the other levels. It was darker, colder, with fewer cameras. The air tasted metallic. The walls had numbers instead of names. And inside those rooms were memories. Old uniforms. Files. Broken helmets. Bits and pieces of those who had come before me. It was a graveyard of control. And in the farthest room, a locked chamber labeled Void Under 07, I found something worse. Videos. Dozens of them. Labeled with names I knew. Some I didn't. Bubbles. Blossom. Me. Footage of our missions. Or failures. Moments of hesitation that had been slowed down, dissected, used as propaganda. Mojo had been recording us for years. Not just battles. Not just fights. Private moments. Training. Conversations. Late night arguments in the living room when we thought no one was listening. He'd had eyes on us for longer than I could comprehend. This wasn't just about control. It was obsession. He didn't want to defeat us. He wanted to own us. I stumbled back, bile rising in my throat. My hands shook as I yanked the drive from the console. I didn't care what alarms I triggered. I had what I needed. Proof. Leverage. Fuel for the fire. Back in my quarters, I stared at the drive, shaking, trembling, but not from fear. From rage. Pure focused rage. Because Mojo Jojo thought he could rewrite my past. Thought he could erase the world I came from and replace it with something sterile and obedient. But now I had the truth. And with Isla silently at my side, I wasn't alone anymore. I didn't need to shout. I didn't need explosions. Not yet. Because the mind games were evolving. And I was done playing defense. It was time to set the board on fire. Chapter 4. Embers in the Dark. Some revolutions don't start with fire. They begin in whispers. In cracked stairs exchanged under fluorescent lights. In broken women passing keys like sacred relics beneath the hum of surveillance drones. They begin in the stillness. In the quiet places no one is supposed to look. The places Mojo Jojo thought he had scrubbed clean. But all he ever did was bury the rot. And now it was rising. The day after I found the footage, I didn't go back to the control chamber. Couldn't. Not yet. The emotions were too volatile. I needed to anchor myself again. To remember who I was beneath the rush of adrenaline and memory and fury. So I went looking for Isla. She wasn't in the mess hall. Or the corridors. Or her usual maintenance circuit. For 3 hours I searched. Quietly. Cautiously. I slipped through blind spots like a ghost. retracing her route, reviewing every camera angle I'd memorized. But the compound was too vast, too tangled, and too smart. And the deeper I pushed into its mechanical heart, the more I felt its pulse shift. She was missing, and it didn't feel random. I was halfway back to my quarters when I heard it, faint and distant, the sound of something dragging, not boots, not machinery, fabric, body, followed it. The corridor narrowed, lights dimmed. It was one of the old maintenance shafts, rarely used now, choked with dust and neglect. I slipped through the half-jammed door and descended the winding stairwell, each step groaning beneath my weight. The room at the bottom was cold, sterile. A storage chamber, abandoned and half-lit. Isla was slumped against the far wall, arms wrapped tightly around herself, as if trying to disappear. She didn't flinch when I entered. She didn't even look at me. "I found the videos," I said softly. "Still nothing. I saw what he did. Me. To them. To you." Her shoulders twitched, barely. But it was something. I knelt beside her. "Loli. Carefully. You don't have to say anything. But I want to know. Who were you before this?" Beat past. Then a breath. "My name was Amelia." Her voice was a whisper, like wind through cracked glass. "I was a teacher. Back in New Townsville." Blink. "Before Mojo." She nodded. "He came to the school. Said he was funding neural literacy programs for children. We thought it was generous. Thought he cared." Her voice cracked on that last word. "I volunteered to help him test the curriculum. He said I was perfect. That I had the right temperament. I thought it was a compliment. He invited me to a private retreat. For educators." She laughed then, just once. "Hello." Shaking. "I never left." I didn't ask how long she'd been here. I could see it in the way her eyes darted toward the corners of the room. In the way her spine curled in on itself like she was trying to disappear. I recognized the posture. That's what survival looked like in Mojo's world. "I wanted to forget," she said. "So I did. I let him take my name, my past, my voice. And for a while, it was easier. But you." She turned to me now, eyes blazing with something raw and barely restrained. "You made me remember." I reached for her hand. She didn't pull away this time. "We're going to burn this place down," I whispered. "Not with bombs. Not yet. With truth. With chaos. From the inside out." She nodded. "And that's when we started planning. We called it the Flicker. The idea was simple. Mojo's system ran on obedience. On routine. On patterns he could predict and control. But if we started interrupting those patterns, subtly, strategically, we could create fractures. Delays. Not just in his machines, but in his mind. It started with the food distribution line. Isla rerouted one of the nutrient flow valves. Just a few degrees cooler. The result? Discomfort. Sluggishness. Disorientation. Nothing severe enough to raise alarms, but enough to make the guards stumble. To throw their rhythm off. Next came the lights. I convinced one of the lower-tier engineers, another of Mojo's cleansed, but not entirely vacant, to recalibrate the central lighting system by 0.03% intensity. The result? A barely perceptible flicker that disrupted the circadian programming of the staff. Fatigue. Paranoia. Microerrors. Then came the whispers. I used the footage. Carefully. Selectively. I uploaded brief clips. Untraceable, context-free. Into the communication channels between departments. Snippets of Blossom's voice. Of Bubbles crying. Of me screaming during training simulations. The goal wasn't exposure. It was confusion. Uncertainty. The system was no longer clean. No longer absolute. Mojo responded quickly. Of course he did. He called for a compound-wide reset. Full diagnostic scan. But he didn't find the source. He couldn't. Because it wasn't a virus. It was a revolt. And it was spreading. More cracks appeared. Guards forgetting their rotation. Engineers muttering about hearing things. Meals arriving late. security doors opening half a second slower than usual. And through it all, Isla and I moved like shadows, observing, coordinating, adjusting. We weren't burning the house down. We were loosening every bolt, waiting for gravity to do the rest. But I knew it wouldn't last, because Mojo wasn't stupid. He didn't need proof. He just needed a pattern. And eventually he'd find one. The real risk wasn't exposure. It was escalation. Because once Mojo Jojo felt threatened, truly threatened, he would stop playing the patient teacher. He would become what he had always been underneath the silk robes and smooth speech. Predator. And predators lash out when cornered. That moment came 5 days later. We were in the garden sector, one of the only places in the compound with organic life. The plants were fake, of course, grown under artificial light in vats of nutrient gel. But the space was quiet, coming. It was where Isla and I met in secret. That day, the lights snapped off mid-conversation. Total blackout. We froze. And then the voice came. Not over the intercom. Inside the room. "You've disappointed me." It was him. Mojo. In person. For the first time in weeks, he wasn't behind glass or screens. He was here. Live. Tall and poised and glowing faintly beneath the emergency red lights. "Subject Zero," he said, and the name sounded like a slur. "I had such hope for you." I didn't move. Didn't blink. "I should have known," he continued, circling me now, voice coiling around my ribs like smoke. "Your kind always returns to chaos. To dysfunction. It's baked into your design." He stopped inches from my face. "I gave you peace. And you spat in my face." "No," I said, voice steady. "You gave me a cage." He smiled. And then Isla stepped forward. "Her name is not Subject Zero," she said, her voice shaking but loud. "Her name is Buttercup." Mojo's eyes snapped to her. And in that second, in that beautiful, perfect second of distraction, moved. Not to strike. Not to flee. But to steal. The drive he carried, his master access, his failsafe. I'd seen it in the control logs. Worn like an ornament at his hip. I yanked it, jammed it into the console embedded in the garden wall, and slammed the override sequence I'd memorized. Siren wailed. The doors slammed shut. Lights strobed. And for the first time since I'd arrived, the compound screamed back. I turned to Mojo, breathless. "This is just the beginning." He lunged. But Isla was faster. And I didn't look back. Chapter 5. The sound of falling walls. Alarms are just noise, until you're the one they're screaming for. The moment I triggered the override and the sirens began howling through the compound, I felt it. Not just in my ears, but in my bones. The hum of the system's panic. The raw, electric fear of a machine made to believe it was invincible. Suddenly unsure of itself. The red lights pulsed like a heartbeat, frantic and sharp. The corridors flashed in stutters, momentary bursts of light and shadow, revealing faces I didn't recognize anymore. Former friends, once programmed allies, the hollow-eyed staff who'd wandered these halls like ghosts now stood alert, frozen in the glitching storm of Mojo's broken order. And somewhere behind me, Mojo Jojo was roaring. Not speaking. Not philosophizing. Roaring. It was the sound of control dying. Isla was already moving. She'd memorized the path through the auxiliary tunnel under the garden sector, and I followed her. Lungs burning, pulse hammering, fingers clutching the stolen master drive like it was holy. Behind us, doors slammed shut in random sequence as the emergency lockdown kicked in, the system struggling to override the override. Mojo hadn't built his world to handle disobedience. And now, it was tearing itself apart. We reached the tunnel access and slipped inside seconds before the lockdown grid dropped like a guillotine. It slammed behind us with enough force to send dust raining from the ceiling. For a moment we just breathed. Heavy. Dark. Live. Isla looked at me. Her eyes weren't dead anymore. They weren't afraid either. "Where to now?" she asked. I slid the drive into the portable interface we'd built in secret. Hacked from two broken communication tablets and a defunct training drone. It wasn't perfect, but it worked. The data began streaming. Dozens of folders, code upon code, security keys, biometric patterns, AI routines. And somewhere inside it, the key to escape. But I wasn't just looking to run. I wanted to ruin him. And that meant releasing the truth. Mojo's compound was more than a prison. It was a broadcast hub. A neural relay site designed to pipe propaganda directly into every school, news terminal, and private AI channel in Townsville. He had access to children's education, therapy programs, public speeches. Everything subtle. Everything invisible. He didn't fight wars with fists anymore. He fought them with ideas. And we had the virus. Isla, I said, turning to her. We're going to upload everything. She froze. Everything. Everything. Not just the footage of us. Not just the mind control. But the files of every person he'd manipulated. Every brain he'd rewired. Every soul he'd quietly stolen. It was the only way to dismantle his myth. I'll start the extraction, she said, already connecting wires with shaking but focused hands. I stood watch as she worked, back pressed to the cold metal wall, eyes fixed on the narrow hallway that stretched toward the central generator. We had maybe 10 minutes, maybe less, time enough for him to send a squad, time enough for him to come himself. But he didn't, not yet. Instead, I heard the system begin to shudder. Deep inside the structure, something groaned. Metal straining, data thrashing. Lights flickered and stayed dark. Screens went static. The pulse of the place slowed, staggered, stumbled. The system was collapsing. We were unraveling the machine from its core. Then I heard it, through the walls, through the pipes, through the whispering vents. Voices, hundreds. First, I thought they were screams. But they weren't. They were waking up. Across the compound, minds were breaking through the fog. Formerly cleansed individuals, once programmed to obey, to serve, to smile, were stirring. Whispers became questions. Questions became shouting. Shouting became chaos. Mojo's empire wasn't falling. It was fracturing. I could feel it. Isla finished the upload. The screen blinked green. One more command. Transmit. Press the button. And then the whole world held its breath. 3 hours earlier, Mojo Jojo stood in his private observatory, watching his empire breathe. The walls were lined with screens, each one a live feed of a sector, a subject, a program. He watched it all with clinical detachment. If there was anything resembling emotion in him anymore, it was so deeply buried beneath layers of strategy and superiority that it might as well have been dead. He was not afraid. He was disappointed. His masterpiece, Subject Zero, was malfunctioning. He had seen it coming, of course. From the moment she resisted the tea. From the way she blinked longer. Asked fewer questions. Reacted too slowly to praise. Too quickly to challenge. She was slipping through his fingers. Like the others. Like Amelia. He turned to the central control node and pressed two fingers to the biometric scanner. A soft chime responded. The AI interface booted. Initialize countermeasure protocol 9, he said. The AI's voice, synthetic and strangely feminine, responded. Countermeasure 9 is in violation of protocol ethics subcode. Override. Immediate. Override confirmed. Releasing neurostatic pulses to zone 4, sector B. It was subtle. Non-lethal. Just enough to disorient. Enough to remind her who the god of this world was. He leaned forward, watching her blur across the screen as she ducked into the garden. And then, nothing. Darkness. Every screen in the observatory blinked out at once. Even Mojo stepped back. Because this wasn't sabotage. This was intentional. Complete system-wide severance. And then the message appeared, written in crude font across every blank terminal. She has a name. And she isn't yours. The moment we released the footage, the transmission spike overloaded the grid. I could see it happening. Power surging, lights shorting, sirens choking off mid-wail. I felt it in my teeth, in my spine, in the electric burn beneath my skin. Every device connected to Mojo's network flickered. Then rebooted. Then played the truth. The video opened on Blossom mid-sentence, recorded without her knowing years ago, late one night in the Townsville compound after a failed mission. "I don't think she even knows how much she's hurting," Blossom whispered, voice raw. "Buttercup. She just wants to feel like she matters, that she's more than her strength, and I don't know how to reach her anymore." Cut to Bubbles, sobbing quietly over a cup of tea. "She doesn't even look at me the same way," she said, hands shaking. "Like she's already halfway gone. Emmy. Lone. Screaming. A training simulation gone wrong. Blood on my knuckles. My voice cracking. I'm not broken. The world saw everything. The invasion of privacy. The manipulation. The brainwashing. Mojo's obsession with control. With domination through emotional dissection. And then they saw his face. Cold. Calculating. Explaining to an aide how he planned to recode me. She's stubborn. Etzel. We break the body, then rebuild the mind. In time, even fire becomes a candle. The world heard it all. And the world reacted. In the compound. Kiss. Screams. Doors slamming. Guards throwing down weapons. Subjects running, pushing, sobbing, fighting. The illusion shattered, the compound imploded. Not in fire, not in bombs, but in truth. And Mojo. He fled. I saw it on the last camera we still had access to him, storming into a hidden transport tunnel beneath the command core. His cloak torn, one eye bloodied, mouth moving with fury. He was escaping. Coward. Could have chased him. But that wasn't the mission. The mission was to end his system. And that was done. Isla and I walked through the compound, now half-lit and trembling, like it was exhaling its final breath. Subjects stumbled into the open air, blinking at light they hadn't seen in years. Some dropped to their knees. Some screamed. Some just cried. I didn't cry. Not yet. But when Isla touched my shoulder, her eyes glassy with shock and something like pride, I felt it rising in my throat. "You did it," she whispered. "No," I said. "We did. And we weren't done. Not yet. Because Mojo Jojo might have lost his fortress. But monsters don't vanish in a day. They run. They rebuild. They wait. And I would be ready." Chapter 6. The Hollow After. They don't tell you what it feels like after the war ends. Not the wars with explosions and flags. I mean the invisible ones. The wars of silence, of stares, of voices in your head that don't belong to you. The ones that leave no visible scars, just holes, gaping ones, where your trust used to be, where your sense of time used to live, where your name used to feel like it meant something. That's the part no one prepares you for. A hollow after. It took 6 hours for the emergency response team from Townsville to reach the remains of Mojo's compound. By then, the system was offline. The guards, those who hadn't fled, were in shock, confused, murmuring fragments of code like prayers. The others, the ones like Isla, had huddled in the corners of corridors, curled into fetal positions, blinking like newborns. And me. I stood in the middle of the wreckage. Motionless. Covered in grime. Wounds raw. Voice gone. I couldn't tell you how long I'd been standing there. My mind had stopped recording time. I remember watching the sunrise filter through the cracks in the compounds, sealing like a god peeking into a dollhouse. I remember thinking how unnatural real light looked after so long under fluorescent lies. The medics tried to talk to me. I didn't answer. Not at first. Because I didn't know how to be anymore. They kept asking questions. Name. Do you remember where you are? Are you Buttercup? The Powerpuff Girl. And I wanted to scream.
Well,
not anymore. All of the above. But the words wouldn't come. Not until I saw her. Bubbles. She burst through the caution tape like it meant nothing, face flushed, tears already streaming. She looked smaller than I remembered.
Softer.
Like she hadn't slept in weeks. Like she had been holding her breath since the day I vanished. Buttercup. That was the moment I broke. Not when I uploaded the truth. Not when the compound fell. Not even when I saw Mojo's face warp in fury as he lost control.
Well,
it was when I heard my name spoken like a lifeline. Like a promise. I dropped to my knees, shaking, and let her hold me. And for a while, there was nothing but sobbing. Not pretty cinematic sobbing. The ugly kind. Mucus and gasps and clutching hands, and the sound of my past crashing into my present at terminal velocity. Blossom was next. She didn't cry. She never did. But her hand on my shoulder said everything. She pulled me back to standing, and I think I collapsed into her more than walked beside her. I was vaguely aware of people moving around me. Doctors, agents, cleanup teams, but it all blurred. I couldn't process any of it. Because I wasn't me yet. Not really. 2 days later. They set up a debriefing facility a mile outside the compound. Sterile, quiet, temporary. I stayed in a room with white walls and no mirrors. I'd asked them to remove all reflections. I couldn't look at myself. Not yet. Isla was in the room across the hall. We hadn't spoken since the fall. She was healing, physically and otherwise. I saw her through the window one night, sitting on the edge of her bed, turning a matchstick over in her hands again and again. Like a ritual. Like a tether. The first time she spoke, it was barely a whisper. They're going to ask you to tell your story, she said. The world wants heroes. I didn't respond. She continued anyway. But I don't think that's what you are. I looked up sharply. You're not a hero, she said again, this time meeting my eyes. You're something harder. You're proof. That sentence sat with me all night. Proof of what? That even the strongest could be broken. That identity was malleable. That love could be twisted into a leash if pulled tight enough. I stared at the ceiling for hours. And when sleep finally came, it wasn't peaceful. It was Mojo's voice, whispering in the corners of my subconscious, telling me I'd never be clean. That no matter how many people I saved, I'd always carry the infection of his influence. 1 week later, the press tour began. They didn't call it that, of course. They called it public rehabilitation outreach. But it was a parade with better lighting. Townsville needed to see me. To believe I was still me. To wrap this story in a bow. They brought me out in soft lighting, dressed me in neutral colors, fed me lines like medication. She was rescued. She was reformed. She was manipulated, but now she's free. But I wasn't free. Not entirely. Because freedom isn't a switch. It's not something you wake up to one morning and stretch into. It's something you fight for. Every time your brain whispers his voice back to you. Every time your hand reaches for a cup of tea and freezes. Every time someone touches your wrist and you flinch without understanding why. I stood in front of cameras, smiling, while inside I was unraveling. They asked me what it felt like to be back. I wanted to say, I'm not back. I'm rebuilt. And I don't know if the parts fit right anymore. Instead, I said, it's good to be home. They clapped. They cried. They moved on. But I didn't. 1 month later, I returned to the city. They didn't restore my title officially. Too risky. Too public. But they let me roam. Let me speak to students. Let me volunteer. Let me be a symbol. But not a soldier. And honestly, I didn't want to be one anymore. Because the battlefield wasn't out there. It was in here. Inside my mind. Every morning, I fought the urge to follow routine's mojo embedded in me. Every night, I questioned my choices, second-guessed my own thoughts, wondered if he had left some code, some phrase, some psychic scar I hadn't discovered yet. PTSD, they called it. Called it residue. And it was thick. Isla moved in with me a few weeks later. She didn't want to be alone. Neither did I. We didn't talk about the compound much. But some nights, I'd wake to the sound of her breathing too fast, her eyes wide, her body tense. I'd grab her hand. She'd grab mine back. And that was enough. Some scars don't fade. They just learn to breathe. 3 months later, Mojo's face resurfaced. Not in real life. On a screen. A hack signal during a newscast. Static, then his voice. Distorted, angry, alive. This is not the end, he said. You have broken my walls. But not my will. His face flickered ghost-like. I am the future you cannot cleanse. The mind is the true battlefield. and you have only delayed the war. Then darkness. I didn't cry. I didn't scream. I turned off the screen and walked to the balcony. The sky was purple. Quiet. But in my gut I felt it. The war wasn't over. And maybe it never would be. But that was okay. Because I was no longer a prisoner. I was no longer his subject. I was no longer broken. I was the warning. The fire. The girl who learned how to burn the walls from the inside. And next time Mojo Jojo came for me, I'd be ready. Chapter 7. My name is Buttercup. There's a difference between escape and freedom. Escape is a moment, a sliver of time where instinct takes over and you run, you break, you fight just hard enough to slip past the bars. But freedom is a process, a slow, aching, brutal resurrection. And sometimes you don't realize how deep the coffin goes until you try to claw your way out of it. I thought taking down the compound would end it. Didn't. I thought exposing the truth would silence him. Didn't. Mojo Jojo may have lost his empire, his monitors, his hive of obedience, but he still lived inside the shadows of my thoughts, curling around the spaces between my breath. He was still there. Always watching. Always waiting. The voice I heard when I doubted myself. The one I feared would never leave. Until the day he made one last move. I was speaking at a youth center in the East District, a place that had once been flooded with his learning modules, masked as educational programs. They'd torn out most of his tech by now, but remnants lingered. Hollow screens, corrupted scripts, warnings embedded in the system's bones. I was halfway through a speech when the lights cut out. The room fell into a breathless silence. Then came the static. And then his voice. Not booming. Not theatrical. Hello, Subject Zero. Every screen in the building blinked to life. His face fractured into a thousand pieces across the monitors. He looked different now. Thinner. Paler. But the eyes hadn't changed. I thought I might never see you again. But here you are. Still speaking to the children. Still pretending to be something you're not. Gasps rang out from the audience. I stood still, hands clenched, staring into his pixelated face. I'm not pretending, I said. Clear. Not anymore. His lips curled. You're not free. You've simply grown comfortable in your new illusion. You think truth sets you free. It only trades one prison for another. I stepped forward, and for the first time I felt nothing. No fear. No guilt. Just a quiet, simmering fury. You don't get to define me anymore. I made you. No, I said. You broke me. And I rebuilt myself from the pieces you left behind. The screens flickered, distorted. You always were the most difficult. You say that like it's a flaw. It is. You're wrong, I said, raising my voice. My defiance is the only part of me you never owned. And then I made a choice. Dangerous one. I walked to the main terminal. Typed a single line of code. The same backdoor command Isla and I used to flood his system with the truth months ago. Only this time. I didn't upload files. He uploaded myself. A full neural simulation of my thoughts, my memories, my rage. My pain. My will. A virus crafted in my own image. A new kind of fire. He tried to interrupt it. I saw his face twitch. His voice stammer. What are you doing? Giving you what you wanted, I said. A perfect subject. And then I hit enter. The screens turned white. No noise. No flicker. Silence. The building's lights returned. And just like that, the ghost of Mojo Jojo vanished from every corner of Townsville. Permanently. 1 week later, I sat at the edge of the lake just outside the city. Bubbles was beside me, drawing hearts in the dirt with a stick. Blossom stood a few feet back, pretending not to watch us, but unable to let her guard down completely. Old habits. We were healing. Together, for once. I thought he'd be the last thing I saw, I said quietly. Bubbles tilted her head. What do you mean? In my life. In my dreams. I thought Mojo would always be there. That I'd never see myself without his shadow. She was quiet for a moment. Then. You don't look like you're in his shadow anymore. I looked down at my reflection in the water, and she was right. For the first time, I recognized the girl looking back. Not the angry one, not the lost one.
Me.
2 months later, they reinstated us officially, not because the city asked for it, but because we were ready, and we wanted to, not to fight monsters or save buildings, but to remind people that strength doesn't always look like fists and explosions. Sometimes it looks like standing in the ruins of your mind and building something better. I trained again, flew again, ate real food, laughed for reasons that weren't tangled in guilt. And slowly, very slowly, I came back to myself, piece by piece. Isla joined the education board. She runs programs for trauma survivors now. Says she likes the quiet. I visit her once a week. Sometimes we talk about him. Sometimes we don't. She told me once, over tea in her small apartment, "You're the reason I remembered my name." And I told her, "You're the reason I believed I still had one." There's a room in my apartment. Small, windowless. Inside it is a single screen, disconnected from every network, running on solar battery backup. Plays one thing. Loop.
Me.
Breaking his system. It's not for vanity. It's not revenge. It's a reminder. Of who I am. Of what I survived. Of who he was. Because forgetting is dangerous. Forgetting makes monsters seem mythical. And Mojo Jojo was not mythical. He was real. He was brilliant. He was sick. And he was beatable.
By me.
Not Blossom. Not Bubbles.
Me.
The one who was hardest to control. The one who screamed back. The one he underestimated. The one who finally said, "No. I don't need a city to love me. I don't need a medal. I don't need to prove anything to anyone. I know who I am now. Not a soldier. Not a subject. Not a project gone wrong. I am Buttercup, and this is my mind, my rules, my freedom, forever."